Did you set things real too?
I said to some of these soldiers, where are your sidearms, as you say? And they said, oh, we had to leave them behind, sir, and all this business. And I said, well, look, you're going to be very vulnerable if you're not armed. Now, I know that Captain Lamont and I sort of got together and we said, look, because I know we had some problems with so-called Burma Defense Army auxiliaries. They were nothing else but bad hats who were quite prepared to kill. And they were killing any stragglers and those who didn't have any firearms. So we decided that we would make groups up so that a few of them had rifles to protect themselves.
Why were they doing this?
I really don't know. I think one of the reasons given to me by an Indian soldier, I wouldn't say a British soldier, he said, Saab, if I'm found with a firearm, then I'll be regarded as a soldier. I've thrown my rifle away. I've gone into Indian clothes. There are a lot of Indians around here. I'll melt with the Indians. The thinking of a British soldier who's so white, without being a firearm, and merging in the with the rest of the population, I don't know. The other thing I think the reasoning there was, well, if the Japs capture me, I've got no firearms. They won't kill me. They'll take me a prisoner, which could have been one very good reason. Because the Japs, you see, as soon as they saw somebody with a firearm, they either shot him or bandaged him. That was it. So he was a threat. He said, well, we did the same thing too. If he's not a Jap come forward to surrender with a rifle in his hand, we sort of shoot him and take his rifle off. So that was the whole thing. It was a total shambles. Nobody seemed to know, except for the little group I had, except for a man's group, nobody seemed to know how they were going to cross the river. So I had a word with some of the fishermen at Lokalu, and they said, well, it's slack tide round about 2 a.m. That's about the best time to cross. Otherwise, when you get the rising tide, you do get a bit of a current. It does help. But what you've got to avoid is the ebb tide, which really goes through. I think we swam about 600 yards. Got to the other side. We were about 4 miles south of Chuide. Chuide was the ferry crossing that was local to Chuide. And they had this little launch that tugged, towed a little platform. So, same, similar thing as they had up north. But I don't know who it was, maybe the RAF and the Japs, they certainly put me in this little launch. But to our good fortune, I was worried about quicksand and things like that. I must say the sand was quite firm. When we did get into the river, well, we were about ankle deep, and then we slowly got across. I managed to get a lot of bamboo, a lot of things to help chaps who couldn't swim to get across. And we got the other side and we broke up. There was a major from the colonies, and there were two officers from the Dukes, and they dated all of us. I said, well, I'm going to head north with my friends. And we did. It took us 3 days to get to war. War was the railhead. The Satang was the railhead, but war was the first station, you see, after that, because they were shelling the western side of the bridge very, very heavily. So you couldn't get any rolling stock up there. So everybody was told to make for war, WAW. That was on the railway line from the Satang to Pigu. I got to war, must have been about the 27th. And a whole lot of people were assembled there. They had brought up supplies, so one got something to eat. But I was very self-sufficient because I ate everything that I got in the villages. And with Karens with me, of course, we ate curry and rice and things like that, which British troops couldn't take, you see. They were so dependent on supplies coming by road and what have you, which was one of the big setbacks, really. See, the Japs moved with a little bundle of rice and dried fish. And another thing I learned from the Japs, when we did kill Japs, and when we captured them, they used to carry a little ball of whole wheat flour, which they put water into and kneaded it into a ball. And I said, what do you do with this? And they said, well, we feel hungry, we just take a chunk off, slip it down the mud, drink water, and it expands in the stomach. It prevents hunger. Oh, this is a damn good idea. And I made my Gurkhas do that after.
I'm surprised that you were managing at this stage to get any Japanese captives.
Killed. Oh, we killed some, yeah. Oh, yes, we killed some.
But you said the Japanese prisoners told you this.
We heard, no, I'm talking about later on. Later on, when they managed to get prisoners. I know we didn't get prisoners in Burma for years. Eh? But I thought at the time, my Karen Jamada said, perhaps he said they make a pancake out of this, and in fact, that's what we were doing. Make a pancake out of this and then put it over a fire. You know, chapatis. Remember chapatis, eh? He said, possibly that. We didn't know. It was only afterwards we realized that this prevented hunger until you were able to get a good meal. Anyway, got to war and then slowly got shipped to Pigu. I got to Pigu, must have been about the 30th or near the 1st. I missed the Battle of Pigu. I then started to have a guardian angel looking after me. I think it was about the 3rd. The Japs attacked on the 4th of March. On the 3rd of March, I was told to go and report to one Burma divisional headquarters up the line at Tonggu. Why? Don't know. See, at that particular time, prior to us crossing the bridge and coming over, we did have local government officers assisting British troops. But they were deserting in their dozens. Quite rightly so, because they were people who didn't want to get involved in any sort of fighting. They realized that the Japs were going to take over Burma. And if they then started interpreting and passing intelligence over to the British, they knew what the Japs were going to do to them, including the Burma Defense Army, who were not too partial towards government servants, whether they were Burmese or British, because they were the authority, which they didn't like. So by the time we got to Pigu, my use, sole use, dwindled, because there were a lot of other officers, British officers, who could speak the language. I met quite a few from the Burma police, from the Forest Service, from the timber firms, who could speak Burmese and therefore could help the forces. I was then told to go to Tonggu to report to 1st Burma Division. All right, as soon as it must have been about, the 3rd. I know it was the day before. There was a huge tank battle because the 7th Hussars had come in from Rangoon. It was a welcome reinforcement. Anyway, I got to Tonggu. It was a bit like British Swift. Stops, machine gunning, bombing by Japanese planes. I got to Tonggu, must have been about the 6th of March. I reported to a chap called Ferguson, I think. And he said, oh yes, now you have been posted to the Chinese military mission. Where is that? Well, he said, you're going up to Lashio. So I said, Well, I had hardly any kit on me, you see. Just a pistol, a bandolier, a pair of shorts. I know I took on boots. I had canvas boots. And I said, well, I've got to get back to base at Mactilla to get some more kit. So he said, well, there is a bit of a hurry. Right, get back to Mactilla as you can. So I got on the train from Tongu. I hopped off at a place called Thazi. And from Thazi to Mactilla, I caught the bus. I went back to the battalion. I told Major Cook what had happened. He said, well, if you've got the orders to go to Lasher, so be it. So I had a couple of suitcases packed with my stuff. Didn't have much, really. And got the bus back to Thazi, and off I went to Lasher. Took me about 3 days to get there. That's via Mandalay, Memeo, Lasher. And that was a very welcome break. Lasher is a beautiful place, about 4,000 feet up in the mountains. Lovely weather. This is getting to March. March is getting terrible down in the plains. And I reported to Colonel Peter Poynton, who was deputy head of the Chinese military mission. Well, Peter Poynton knew my father well. A lovely desk there now in the bungalow. And I said, well, what am I going to do with the Chinese, for him's sake? He said, I don't speak any Chinese. He said, well, they do want liaison officers. They've got their own British officer interpreters with them. But the idea is that you will be accompanying Chinese formations, and your job is virtually interpreter duties, because these British officers don't speak Burmese, and that's A. And B, to see that they get supplies as they go along the line. Okay. He said there's no real movement yet. It's all politics. Chiang Kai-shek is talking to Wavell, and Slim is talking to somebody else, and they got a chap called Stillwell here. He is directing as to whether the Chinese will come into Burma to help us or not. So he said, in the meantime, take it easy. The club is there. There's a nice golf course. And, oh, boy, I had a lovely... I must have been 10 days there. And then after the 10th day, a train arrived into Lasher Station. I think they were coming through from the Chinese border, a place called Loi Wing. I don't know exactly where, but there was this train load. It was a battalion of Chinese troops, part of the 200th Motorized Division, which was commanded by Stillwell. They pulled into Lasher Station. They were there for 3 days. I then hopped on the train. I'd taken my Batman with me, so I took the Batman with me, Gurkha Batman. And I shared a carriage with their officer, liaison officer, Captain Patrick O'Hara, Paddy O'Hara, who seemed to be indifferent to everything that went on. He wasn't interested in anything. He just stayed in his compartment and then read, and that was it. He wasn't interested in anything. In fact, I used to be badgered by a colonel who kept on asking me for Cully, Cully, Cully all the time. What on earth is this Cully? So I asked Paddy O'Hara, I said, what is this Cully? He said, vegetables. I said, oh, crikey. Where the hell am I going to get vegetables? Anyway, using a bit of initiative, I thought, right, we got to Memeo. Before we left Lasher, I rang the railway station master at Memeo and said, look, we're going to have a whole train load of Chinese. And they're a dangerous bunch, this lot. If you do not provide vegetables for these chaps. You know, the Chinese love vegetables. Eh? What sort of vegetables, sir? I said, well, cabbage, cauliflower, tomatoes, cucumbers, you name it. He said, what about chickens and all? I said, well, I don't know about that at all. I had a word with the heart, and he said, they need any bloody thing. He said, oh yeah, make sure that there's enough rice. So we got to Maimiao. Chinese are very belligerent. They were coming around into Burma on sufferance. It didn't matter whether the first-class passenger train was on platform one. It had to be shifted from this Chinese troop train to arrive on platform one. All the pots and pans were then put onto the platform, and a lovely good cooking spree went on.
Carry on.
You know, big cooking jamboree, and I enjoyed, I must say, a few Chinese dishes. Once they'd fed and what have you, all their equipment went on board, and depending on the film of the, I think there was Major General aboard. I never got to meet him, but I met this colonel who spoke French. Didn't understand him very much. When he decided to move, he moved. And every train had to get off the railway line for this troop train. I don't know whether it was the very first Chinese troop train that had come down that way. I think it probably was. Anyway, from there we got to Mandalay. Telephoned the station master, Mandalay, said, make sure you have people aboard. Get in touch with the Burma Army Service Corps. That's their job. Want supplies. Get to Mandalay, straight on to platform one. We stayed there 3 days while the general enjoyed sightseeing in Mandalay. I was on board there. Then from there, we progressed to Chauksei. To the same thing at Chauksei. By which time, I had a word with this colonel through O'Hara and said, you know, I don't think that I'm any use to you people, because I don't speak your language. There's very little I've been doing in the way of interpreting. I said, Captain O'Hara here knows what I've done as far as supplies are concerned. He's quite capable of getting the station master, they all speak English, from ringing the next station to have supplies ready for you, whether you know if you need them or not. And he said, yeah, yeah. So I said, look, this is Parsi. I've only got to go 18 miles and I'm back to my regimental headquarters. So he said, yeah, okay. So I detrained. Spend the night in the station because the bus service only starts the following day. And there's me back in Mektila now. By which time it's about getting near third week in March. Yes, it must have been third week in March. I go and report to my dear old Eddie Cook, the second commander, I love the old man. And he said, so what do I do now? He said, I don't know where 2nd, 5th Gurkhas are, 14th Brigade. He said, well, from what we hear, where you went up north from Peking, they've gone westwards up the Prome section, along the Irrawaddy riverbank. You see, the map is such that you've got the Irrawaddy there. Prome this way, Mandalay this way. The Japs were trying to capture the governor and General Alexander, who'd already arrived, at a place called Tao Chan. Tao Chan was the road junction for Pigyu one way and Prome the other. And the Japs went to form a roadblock, and of course they had a hell of a time getting through, but they managed to get through in the end. 17 Div with 48 Brigade, 46th Brigade were moving up the Prome Road. In the meantime, the plan, as I see it now, was for one Burdiv who were in Tongu to eventually move across and join up with 17 Div, make two divisional strengths. But one Burdiv were tied up with the Japanese, that lot that I departed from at Tarzi, and several others, I learned later, were brought down. Some came down in trucks. And then the big battle of Tongu took place on April Fool's Day. April the 1st. I missed all that. So, Cook said, well, I don't have any idea where 17 did is, but it's along that probe road somewhere. He said, look, son, the best thing you can do is get on back to Thursday, get on the train, go up to Pimina. From Pimina, take the small line to Tangwinji. And then, back here, when you get to Tangwinji, go and try and find them in Magwe, along the Irrawaddy. So I did that. So it took me about 3 days again. We're getting to April 2nd, 3rd. Now, when I get to Magwe, there's the RAF there. They're on the airfield there. I'm just one man with an orderly. I make inquiries. No British troops, no Indian Gurkha troops have come up. We're further down at a place called Thiepnir. So, oh yes, in the meantime, before I'd left Mexico, Cook said, no, look, if you are in any difficulties, report to the Burma Frontier Force Depot at Yaning Jam. He said, John Appleby is an old friend of mine. He said, I believe he's commanding the depot. It's a remount depot. It's in the stables of a racing owner called Ali Shah. I said, okay. He said, if you get lost there and you don't see anybody. I went over to the RAF headquarters and they were sort of working at half strength. They were getting bombed to hell and machine gun, and they were getting up in the air. They had some AVG. General Wavell flew in at a conference with somebody. I heard that Smite, General Smite RGOC, got the sack for the Satang disaster. He was flown out to India on the same plane. Well, they went to Chongqing, actually, because Wavell was negotiating with Chiang Kai-shek. Smythe was very ostracized. He managed eventually to get to India. Wavell totally ignored him, but he was an absolute washout. There was too much of that. Everybody blaming everybody else. And I think we junior officers got most of the blame. It didn't matter whether we were involved or not. We always got the blame. They expected us to do the most horrific things with nothing armed. Eventually, when I took over FF8, it was ridiculous. We had Lewis guns, 2-inch mortars. I had a 45 pistol that went off on its own. It was so badly put together. But I got, as I say, I went to the RAF, and they said, oh, we've got a truck going to Yangon. So I said, can I hop on? Yes, fine. There was a lot of bombing down at the docks, and the wing commander there said, look, I said, what's the bombing got to do with it? He said, well, there's some hospital
1792 orders ready.
There's some hospital. The Irrawaddy Flotilla Company ran huge launches, enormous launches, and they towed what they call flats alongside each. Some of them had two, some had single. And those flats took supplies like rice, heavy stuff. What was happening, they were using these Irrawaddy flotilla boats with the Red Cross painted on the top of all the three flats, and they were bringing the wounded up from southern Burma. The Japs ignored all that, they kept machine gunning and bombing us a lot. The wing commander said to me, look, there's a young Indian doctor working on his own with two nurses, Eurasian nurses. He said, you think you're going to give him a hand? I said, yeah, why not? So I got down to the jetty there and made my number with the doctor. And he said, well, the only thing I can ask you to do is, there's such a lot of dead here. Could you organize a burying party with the villagers? I said, yes. In the meantime, there was an anti-aircraft unit of the Burma Auxiliary Force, all Anglo-Burmese boys, and they kept pooping at these bombers that came over, but they never reached them at all. And of course, bombs are crashing. I got these chaps, said, come on, we've got to help with these people. There was sand on the sandbanks, so it's better than there, as many as we could. I left this doctor and the two nurses, and we were all there, and eventually I told the sergeant, who who I knew, actually, I knew from Burma. I said, no, what are you going to do? And he said, I don't know, sir. What's the, how much ammunition have you got? He said, hardly any left. So I said, have you got any towing vehicles? Oh, yes. I said, right, hitch up the guns, Yelingjani. So we all went off to Yelingjani. I then reported to Appleby at the Burma Frontier Force headquarters. Did nothing there for about 5 days, except I was a great horseman. I was brought up on horseback. I rode myself silly. I rode one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the evening. On the fifth day, a chap called Major Gregory Stapleton came over from Mimbu. He was the OC of the Burma Frontier Force column of the Southern Shan States Battalion, numbered FF8. He came over, and Appleby introduced me. There were two other officers there. I think one was an Irishman who was under open arrest for being a conscientious objector or something. And something was happening. There was a chap called Roger Beeden. He was in some sort of trouble. Anyway, I told Stapleton that I knew his brother, Hugh. Oh, he said, marvelous. So he said, look, you'd like to come and join me? I'm over at Mimbu. I need a second officer. I've got a mounted platoon, a mounted infantry platoon, run by this chap, Ali Shah's son. But he said, I don't rely on that guy. I said, he said, the first shot and he'll disappear. So I said, fine, if you clear that with Burma Rifle headquarters. And he said, well, no bother at all. Appleby's been in touch. He knew that I wanted another officer, and he got in touch with Cook and Magdalena to say, we're having this guy. So I go across on the ferry to Mimbu with my two suitcases and what have you. I share the house of the police chief there, and Stapleton's in the same house as well. After about a week, Stapleton says, look, it's no good keeping all the troops here. I'm going to disperse them, put them out in outposts. We hear that the Japs are coming up on this west bank, but there's a brigade further down, a place called Minha. Let's get the men out instead of sitting in barracks all the time and being bugged along. Get them out on route marches and sort of toughen them up, you know. As I say, then check the weaponry. We have four Lewis guns that they used in the First World War. Mind you, those Lewis guns are good. You know, you could spray them like a garden spray. I think we had one Bren. And we had 2-inch mortars, like little pipes. You could fire them from the thigh. That was all. Plus 303 rifles. I managed to get myself a Thompson machine gun from one of the RAF chaps in Bugui. So at least I was armed, but with very limited ammunition. So, that was the second in command of FF8.
Frontier Force 8.
Right.
What does the H stand for?
They had these columns numbered 1 to 9.
Column number 8?
Yeah, column number 8. But classed as FF8. And FF1, FF2. Remember earlier on I talked about FF2. There was an FF9 run commanded by a chap called Ian Scott, who I'm in communication with. He lives in Edinburgh.
But this is part of the Burma Rifles?
No, Burma Frontier Force.